The following message is from Pastor Steve Lee of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
Morning, everyone. This year's Advent series will be the start of also our exploration of the Gospel of John, which I'm entitling Beholding Glory. And so during these next 3 weeks that are leading up to Christmas, we'll be looking at chapter 1 and then the first part of chapter 2 of John's Gospel as the Advent series that launches us into this series in John. And glory is one of the major themes of the Gospel. In fact, the first half of the book, which is basically chapter 1 to 12, is sometimes referred to as the Book of Signs. And then the second half of the book, chapters 13 to 20, are known as the Book of Glory. And I'm not going to go into a deep explanation of why they're called that right now, but as we get further along into the gospel, I'll unpack that a bit for you as to why it's called the Book of Signs and then the Book of Glory. I also wanted to explain the cover art a little bit for the series. I normally don't do that, but I think there's it'll be helpful for you to understand why I chose the artwork that I did for this. It basically consists of three stained glass panels. And the left panel depicts the tree of life. And then the right panel depicts the cross. And what I'm going to do something different this series that I normally have not done in other sermon series, but I'm going to change the middle panel every week with a new image that illustrates the theme of that message. And hopefully by the end of today's message, you'll understand why I chose a tent for the middle panel, as well as why the bookends of every week will be the tree of life and the cross, okay? Let's begin with a word of prayer then. We'll just jump right into it. God, as we continue the celebration of Advent, I pray that what would happen within our hearts is that you would stir within us such an anticipation of the Christmas celebration, of the wonder and the joy of the thought that you so loved us that you gave us your one and only Son, that he would take on flesh and blood like us, to become one of us, that flesh and blood might be in an unbelievable way, torn apart for our benefit. And so grant to us understanding of these opening words of John's gospel. These are, we admit, difficult words to understand. And yet, through the work of your Spirit, open our eyes to see who Jesus is in light of these words. For it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke are known as the Synoptic Gospels. And the reason why we call them that is because they are very similar in content to one another. When you study them side by side, it's very clear that they could not have been written independently of each other. There's just way too much overlap in what they say, sometimes almost word for word identical passages. And what we now have come to understand is that very likely Mark was the first gospel written, and then Luke and Matthew borrowed heavily from Mark's gospel to write their own gospel. But John is unlike any of these gospels. It is unique. It contains a lot of stories that are not mentioned in the Synoptic Gospels, and it totally ignores a lot of very key stories in those three Gospels as well. So it's very clear that John was writing from a very different perspective, with a very different purpose for his Gospel. And that contrast becomes very obvious at the very beginning of the Gospel. When you begin reading the Gospel of Mark, it begins with Jesus already an adult, and now he is being baptized by his cousin, John the Baptist. Matthew goes earlier to the birth of Jesus as his starting point to his story. Luke will go a little bit further back to the events that surround the birth of John the Baptist, so that's a bit earlier than Jesus' birth. But John goes all the way back to the creation of the universe. That's how he begins his story. And so let's look at the opening words of the gospel and try to unpack it. In verses 1 through 5, as we just heard read by our students, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life. And that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. It's hard to miss the echoes of Genesis 1 in John 1. Because in Genesis 1, it starts with the creation of the universe. And it says just like this, in the beginning. And then it follows of how God made everything in the universe, including light, which shines into the darkness. And it becomes a major focal point of John chapter 1. And John does this to show us that the story of Jesus is actually part of a much bigger story that finds its beginnings in the very first pages of the Bible. And although Genesis never mentions Jesus, John tells us that it was actually Jesus. He was the one that made everything that we see in our world. Now, some of you may be wondering, well, I don't get it. Where do you get Jesus from this? There's no mention of Jesus here. And you're right. But as you read further in chapter 1, it becomes absolutely clear that John is talking about Jesus. But interestingly, at least at this point, he doesn't call him Jesus. He refers to him as the Word. And why does he do this? Why is he seemingly speaking in riddles by calling Jesus the Word? Well, this term, the Word in English, is the Greek word logos. And it's a bit complicated to understand, but logos captures the idea of the divine reason that orders our universe, that gives meaning to it. You can think of it as the way that we can make sense of our world around us, to understand its purpose for which it was made. Another way you can think about this word logos is the mind of God. In other words, logos is like God's fingerprint that can be seen in every aspect of his creation that shows us what God is like and what his purpose for his creation is, what his plan for us is. That captures the idea of logos, the divine rationality that explains the design of the universe, okay? Now, I get that that's kind of pretty complicated idea to understand, but what's interesting is, if you read the book of Proverbs, this idea of wisdom is very similar to this Greek idea of logos. In Proverbs 8, wisdom is personified as a lady. And this woman speaks in chapter 8 and explains what she is all about. And she says, I was there at the very beginning of creation. And so Proverbs 8, 22 to 26 says this, the Lord brought me forth as the first of his works, before his deeds of old. I was formed long ago at the very beginning when the world came to be. When there was no watery depths, I was given birth. When there were no springs overflowing with water. Before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, I was given birth. Before he made the world or its fields or any of the dust of the earth. So what wisdom, Lady Wisdom, is saying was, I came first of all of God's creation. And out of my wisdom, I am, in essence, what the book of Proverbs will say is that wisdom is woven into the very fabric of the universe. It's imprinted as the DNA of everything God created. Without wisdom, we cannot understand the meaning or the purpose of life as God intended. And so it goes on in chapter 8, verse 32 to 36 of Proverbs. Now then, my children, listen to me. Blessed are those who keep my ways. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Do not disregard it. Blessed are those who listen to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. For those who find me find life and receive favor from the Lord. But those who fail to find me harm themselves. All who hate me love death. Basically saying, through wisdom, we are basically going to choose the fundamental path in life that we're going to go on. Whether we're going to choose life or death, life with God or life apart from God. This is the idea of logos. Choosing the way of wisdom means understanding who God is and what he wants for us, and then living in accordance to that understanding because of our trust in him. And what John tells us is something remarkable. He says this idea of wisdom, this idea of logos, this idea of what is woven into the very fabric of God's universe, well, he says Jesus is that way of wisdom. He is the true divine logos, a light that shines in the darkness, who shows us the way to God. And that's why he continues in verse 6 to 8. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. Now, this is not talking about himself. This is kind of confusing because there's John, the writer of the gospel, and then there's also John the Baptist. And this is John the Baptist. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. But then as the story goes on, rather than turning to the light that Jesus offered, the world would reject him. Verses 9 through 11, the true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. It's not surprising that Jesus was rejected, because our rejection of God was right there from the very beginning of the story. The creation story tells us that we were made to worship God and trust in his goodness and care over us. As ones who are made in his image, we were also called to love and care for one another, as well as to care for his creation. This is the logos. This is the divine wisdom, to live in obedience to this plan of God for us. But Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit. Why? Because they lost trust in God. The serpent had convinced them that by forbidding them from eating this fruit, God was holding out on them, keeping them from knowledge that would have made them as powerful as God himself. And so they were convinced that if they ate this fruit, they believed they would not have to depend on God anymore, but that they could figure things out for themselves. And so rather than trusting in God's wise care over them, they chose the path of relying on their own wisdom. God's wisdom is the path of love and self-sacrifice. But the so-called knowledge that Adam and Eve gained by eating the forbidden fruit was driven by self-centered fear. And it caused them to turn not only against God, but on one another. And so it's not surprising that when God confronts Adam after they ate the fruit, his first instinct is to blame Eve rather than to protect her or to take personal responsibility for his part in the defiance. And it's shocking how quickly sin escalates from there, because within one generation, the first murder is going to be committed when their children get sucked up into this drama. Cain kills his brother Abel. And then God shows mercy to Cain, promising to protect him from any others who may seek revenge on him. And he says this in Genesis 4. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord said to him, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. This is a demonstration of God's grace to protect Cain, but showing how twisted our hearts had become. Lamech will hear of this, and he will end up distorting it into his own really violent, self-centered means. And it says this in 4:23 to 24. Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, "Listen to me, wives of Lamech. Hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me. a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. What he is saying is this: I don't need God's grace. I don't need his protection over me. You see what happens when somebody touches me. Anyone who dares lay a hand on me, I will wreak vengeance, not seven times, but 77 times. And with each succeeding generation, things go from bad to worse, till we reach this low point in what is probably some of the saddest words that we find in the entire Bible, in Genesis 6, chapters 5 through 6. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. This is how the story of humanity begins. And it's this story that John is tapping into when he tells the story of Jesus. At the close of my Job series earlier this year in the spring, I referenced Terrence Malick's 2011 film, The Tree of Life. And I wanted to draw your attention to it again because I think it fits so well in today's message. But I'm going to highlight aspects of it that I didn't really talk about back in the spring. In the center of this story is a family, a mom, a dad, and three boys living in the 1940s and 50s in Texas. And very early in the film, we're presented with two paths in life. One is called the way of grace, and the other is called the way of nature. And the way of grace is the way of wisdom that I've been talking about here. It is understanding the world that God has made, living in accordance to that knowledge of his wisdom. It is the way of self-giving love, of kindness toward others, mercy, forgiveness. The way of nature, though, is the exact opposite. It fights against life as God intended. It seeks its own rather than serving others. Rather than submitting to God's way, it says, I know better than God. I know how to make a way for myself. This way of nature is driven by fear and self-preservation. And it is described as an effort to control things, to dominate over others, manipulating them to get them to do what we want them to do. And in this movie, the mother, Mrs. O'Brien, represents the way of grace. But the father, Mr. O'Brien, represents the way of nature. You see, Mr. O'Brien is haunted by his own failures. He never pursued his first dream, which was to become a musician. And the problem is, he can't even find success in his fallback career as a factory manager. He had hopes, in other words, of becoming a big person one day. But he knows deep inside that his life has become a disappointment. He will never amount to much, at least not the way he measures success. And the way that Mr. O'Brien compensates for his failures is his determination to raise his boys to be successes. And so what you find as the movie unfolds is that he constantly lectures his eldest son, Jack, with these life lessons. One of them, as he's grilling some hot dogs on the grill, he says to Jack, Toscanini once recorded a piece 65 times. You know what he said when he finished? It could be better. Think about it. That's what he says to his son. And constant criticism flows from his mouth about everything that his son Jack does. Rather than being able to enjoy creation as a gift of God, Mr. O'Brien sees it as something that must be controlled, subdued, bent to his will. And this is illustrated in the movie by the way that he is constantly working on his yard, pulling weeds from a garden, the beauty of which he never can appreciate. In one scene, he forcefully grabs his son Jack by the arm and drags him throughout the lawn, pointing out all the places where he has failed in his yard work. And in his distress, his son Jack turns and he grabs his father and hugs him, looking for some comfort. But Mr. O'Brien turns away from that hug, embarrassed at his son's search for intimacy and connection. The scenes around the dinner table are among the most painful to watch. There are no happy memories of mealtimes in the O'Brien household. The O'Brien table is not a place for love and communion. Instead, every meal becomes an occasion for Mr. O'Brien to teach his sons another life lesson, pointing out their failings like chores that weren't done properly earlier that day. And one scene when Jack politely asks his father to pass him some food, saying, "Please," Mr. O'Brien angrily corrects him, "Please, sir." You see, nothing is ever good enough for him. All of this is driven by Mr. O'Brien's desire to instill his sons with skills that he believes will lead them to success. But he himself understands almost nothing about the true meaning of life. By the time Jack reaches adulthood, you see the full impact of this formation that he has received from his father. He has fulfilled his father's wildest dreams. He's become successful. But he is haunted by a deadness of his soul that all of his outward successes cannot heal. Peter Lighthart comments on this story, and he says this: "Jack is not the only one with a desert in his soul. He inherited the desert from his father. Mr. O'Brien's soul is shrunken with shame, and he passes his own sense of failure and shame to his boys. He trains his boys with a regimen of masculine toughness, but since it emerges from his own weakness and failure, all he teaches them is the way of the desert, where there is no tree of life. As an adult, Jack is far more successful than his father. He lives in a clean, upscale house of windows, and he works at the top of a glass skyscraper where he seems to hold a high position in an architectural firm. He has achieved the success his father always longed for, but Jack's demeanor throughout the film indicates success in this form is hollow, stale, tasteless. Life passes by the successful and the failures unless they see the glory that smiles through everything. From this perspective, Jack is a modern everyman. He has pursued career, success, and money, and it's all worked. He is at the top of the world, regularly ascending in an elevator to offices high above the city. Inside, he is dead. Nothing grows." This, to me, is a sad picture of intergenerational sin. The kind of sin fathers hand down to their children, a legacy of brokenness that we've inherited from our own parents. It's a rejection of life as God intended, life on our own terms, according to our own wisdom. And the truth is, this is the sad story of humanity. When Adam and Eve turned against God and ate the forbidden fruit, they were banished from the Garden of Eden. You find this in Genesis 3, verse 24. "After he drove the man out, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life." In other words, by eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they were now cut off from the tree of life. With sin came death. And what I want to say next is probably one of the most important things I'm going to say to you this morning in this message. One of the biggest misconceptions of Christianity is that its primary purpose is to answer the afterlife problem. Do you know where you're going to go when you die? What I want to argue is that the Bible doesn't frame salvation like this. Yes, Adam and Eve's problem is that they are banished from the Garden of Eden and they no longer have access to the tree of life, which means they will die. But what you have to understand is that this banishment is the end result of a much bigger problem, which is their broken relationship with God, which is a result of their mistrust of Him and their desire to live their lives apart from Him and care for themselves rather than come under the care of God. The punishment of death is not the primary focus, but it's what led to that punishment, which was nothing less than rebellion against God. And to say, rather than choosing God's way, I'm going to choose my way. I think I know better than God what is best for my life. In fact, the Bible defines death as separation from God. It describes it relationally. It is rejecting the way of wisdom and choosing to live life on our own terms. That is spiritual death, according to the Bible. Look at what it says in Proverbs 3, which is so fascinating to me. Blessed are those who find wisdom, those who gain understanding, for she is more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. Her ways are pleasant ways, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her. Those who hold her fast will be blessed. By wisdom, the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding, he set the heavens in place. What it's saying is choosing God's way, the way of wisdom, is access to the tree of life. What real living is all about. Maybe I can explain it like this. Imagine a situation where a teenager is spiraling out of control. He starts hanging around a bad crowd, and it's leading him down some pretty destructive paths. And now that he has his driver's license, he can start to go places where he shouldn't be and do things that he knows he shouldn't be doing. And no matter what his parents try to do, nothing is working. And so they make the difficult decision to basically ground him kind of almost indefinitely and take away his driving privileges. Now imagine if you're that teen. What if you saw your problem as nothing more than recovering the privileges that were lost? Well, if that's your mentality, then you'll probably do one of two things. You will likely try to comply with whatever your parents tell you to do, whatever rules that they've set in place, in order to regain your driving privileges so that you can resume your out-of-control life as soon as you can start driving again. Or you may even rebel against them and sneak out of the house late at night when they're sleeping and grab the car keys. But what if that teen could see that his problem was so much deeper than just losing driving privileges or being grounded? What if he could come to the realization that his parents had limited his freedom because they were so concerned about his life that was spiraling out of control with the destructive choices that he was making? If he could understand that about his situation, then he may respond very differently to what was happening to him. In the same way, the fear of not knowing where we're going when we die is not enough. The way back to God begins when we realize our biggest problem is that we have turned our back on him. It's not, in other words, the hell problem, that I'm just afraid that I'm going to go to the wrong place when I die. That is not sufficient motivation to lead you into a loving relationship with God. It never does. Self-preservation is not enough. It's not until we truly understand the story that the Bible is telling, a story of our turning against God in relationship with him, that we begin to take the first steps back to him. Here's the problem, though. The problem is that none of us are willingly able to come to that realization ourselves. Another way to put it is this. We're not only spiritually lost, we don't want to be found by God. That's the condition all of us find ourselves in. And so God did for us what we could not do for ourselves, sending his son, Jesus, into our world to restore our broken relationship with him. The remainder of the passage reads like this. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, "This is the one I spoke about when I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.'" Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Now he finally names him. It's Jesus that he's been talking about all along. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. That term, made his dwelling, is literally translated as he pitched his tent among us. And that's where we get the word tabernacle from. In the most extraordinary act of identification, God took on flesh and blood and became one of us, so that he could offer his life on our behalf and show us the way back to the Father. That's the full message of salvation, as the Bible itself would frame it. You know, it's interesting that whenever I used to read verse 17, it says, "For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came from Jesus Christ." I always thought that John was pointing out that the law is opposite of Jesus. In other words, the law is all about rules and punishment, but Jesus came to offer grace and forgiveness. But that's actually not what John says. If you look at verse 16, the contrast is not that. Because look at what it says in the prior verse. "Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given." In other words, what John is saying is both the law and Jesus were demonstrations of God's grace. Why? Because the law also shows God's grace, because it shows us the way of wisdom. It shows us the kind of life that we needed to live in order to please God. That's grace. The problem, though, was that that law was an insufficient grace, because it didn't have the power to change us. It could only point us in the right direction. But what the Gospel of John will reveal is that Jesus came not only to teach us the kind of life that God desires, but to make us into children with new hearts capable of actually living that life. And I think that's the beauty of the gospel message. Not only to point us the way to God, but to actually change us so that we actually desire that life for ourselves. It's one of the great comforts to me that God gave us not more principles, not another set of laws, not even prophets, because when you read the prophets, it is so confusing because they speak in dreams and oracles and these riddles, and you don't know what they're talking about half the time. And let's be honest here. Sometimes we read the Old Testament and it is confusing. The God of the Old Testament can be very confusing because so much of it comes through these flawed messengers. Among the best of them was King David, and look at how much he screwed up. And so what the writer of Hebrews says is, in the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he has made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. He didn't give us more principles or more laws, more rules. He didn't give us more prophets or messengers. But what it says is, in the last days, as the ultimate expression of his love for us, he gave us his Son. And I think I've been sharing with you this place I've been in my sabbatical. And I don't know. It's just, the older I get, the less I feel like I know. And it's very humbling. Things that I was thinking were so simple suddenly just seem so complicated. And I think that's why, as I get older, I am just drawn more and more to the person of Jesus Christ. And as I've been meditating on who Jesus is, What I've been feeling in the genuine depths of my heart is what Jesus represents for me is everything that I wish God was. That's how I feel about Jesus. Is if someone told me God was going to become a man, what kind of a man would he be? What I see in the pages of these Gospels encourages me like nothing else. Because the Jesus that I see in the pages of Scripture is exactly who I want God to be. A God that I feel I can approach in my weakness. A God who understands everything that I go through. A God for whom no one is forgotten or discarded. Let's pray.